Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Week That Really Was with John McGurk and Sarah Ryan. It is this being going out at least on Friday, the 19th of April, but we're recording at about 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 18th of April. And if you hear me cheering, it'll be because Atalanta have scored against Liverpool, though they have failed to do so far. I am joined this week, I'm very fortunate to be joined this week by two wonderful women. The first is my always effervescent co-host, Sarah Ryan. Sarah, how are you?
Effervescent, John. That's a new one. I'm good, thank you. I'm having a good week. Nothing to report except all of the interesting political developments that are happening this week.
Okay. Well, we will keep it there because I want to introduce our other guest. Her name is Helen Joyce, but if you don't know her, she is the author of the Amazon best-selling book, Trans, When Ideology Meets Reality, which was published in 2021 and has been in paperback since 2022. It won the Times of London and indeed Spectator Book of the Year. It's a top 10 bestseller in the UK and indeed on the aforementioned Amazon. But more exciting than that, because when I was a young person kind of growing up, the idea of ever talking to somebody as high-powered as an editor with The Economist, which was always when I was growing up, the magazine / newspaper, as they call themselves, for smart people. She is their former Britain editor. She is also a former graduate, like myself, of Trinity College, though probably a more diligent one, and has a master's from Cambridge and a PhD from University College London. She is an incredibly qualified woman, and I'm delighted to say hello to you. Helen Joyce, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
The reason we have you on is because we want to talk this week about the CAS review and indeed have a wider conversation about its implications, not only on policy, but on sort of society and societal trends around the issue that it discusses. So I'll start with a simple question. What is the CAS review? How did it come about and what did it find?
Right. So this is a review that's been running for nearly 4 years and it published last week its final recommendations and findings. And it was done by Dr. Hilary Cass, who's a very eminent paediatrician here in the UK, where I am based now. So, for example, she's a former president of the Royal College of Paediatrics. So she was commissioned by the government to do an examination of NHS child gender services. It's a bit shocking when you realise how long there have been concerns about these services. The first whistleblower, Sue Evans, raised concerns about the clinic, that the clinic is called JIDS, Gender Identity Development Service, 20 years ago now, in 2004. So to wind back a bit, the way that specialist services work, even in a biggish country like the UK, that if you've got very diseases that require people to, they would otherwise only see a person every year or two, you put them in specialist centres. And for children and gender identity issues, they used to be so rare that there was just one centre in the whole of England called JIDS at a famous clinic called the Tavistock in London. And the practice there, we now know, I mean, it's been obvious to anyone who's looked into it for years and years, but Dr. Cass has written it down in black and white and submitted it to the government. The government has accepted that. The practice there has wandered awfully far from proper and standard medical practice. So in her very measured language, she explained that the children who were referred there with severe gender issues, kids who were very distressed about being male or female and who wished and wanted to be the opposite sex and who identified as the opposite sex, the treatment that they got was not evidence-based. And they were given really potentially life-changing treatments without any evidence that it would help them. So the treatment pathway from certainly from 2014 and maybe from as early as 2011 was that a kid might, after just a few appointments, like a long time on the waiting list, by the way, getting very distressed. And then they'd come in and they'd have quite superficial appointments with very poor notes taken and then be put on puberty blockers. And these were sold as a sort of a pause button while the child could grow up a bit. But the thing is, they stop you from growing up a bit because puberty is what makes you grow up. It's what turns you into adults. And more than that, it potentially disrupts your brain development permanently. There's evidence now that that's quite likely, and weakens your bones because it's during puberty that your bones get strong. And also, of course, all your friends are growing up without you and you're just getting more and more distressed. And the final thing that it does is it stops you from realizing what your sexuality is, because most of us work out whether we like people the same sex as us or opposite sex in puberty. And actually, a lot of kids who are gender distressed young, it turns out when they hit puberty that that was just about them being a bit different because they're gay and they stop being gender distressed. So these were the drugs that were being given until kids were 16, and then they would be prescribed cross-sex hormones, and then when they were 18, they would put onto surgery. And this is a pathway that leads to sterility, to not having a happy sex life, and because you won't be able to orgasm if you start puberty blockers too young. And all of this was done without any real evidence that it would help the thing that it was meant to help, which is the gender distress. And so Hilary Cass commissioned a major, the world's best so far, research of all the evidence regarding the use of puberty blockers. And she concluded that there was no evidence that it helps with gender dysphoria. And of course, there are these very significant harms against it. And she also concluded that one of the things that's often said about gender distress in childhood, namely that if you don't give the child puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, they'll kill themselves, that that was flatly false. There is no reason to give a child this treatment pathway in order to save their life.
Because this the theory, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, what the other side of this argument would say, their theory is basically that if you're an 11-year-old child and you're a young boy and you say, I believe I'm a girl, that going through puberty means that you will, your penis will grow, your hair in your chest, you might start getting facial hair and have to stay. So you look more and more like a man, and in order to assuage that and to remove them from the terrifying distress of looking more like who they say they're not, the best idea is to stop all that. That's the theory. But was there ever any medical evidence back that up?
It's even worse than that. That was one theory. Like, one of the things that you'll find when you dig into this particular field is that they know the outcome they want, which is for the meaning of male and female to be whatever you say you are, not what your body is. And that requires that you socially transition. Like, if somebody says that they're he, him, and you can see it's a woman, you have to go along with he, him, and vice versa. If you can see it's a man and that man says that he's a woman and she, her, you've got to go along with that. And it requires that you do these major interventions for children because you don't believe sex is real. You believe the gender identity is real. So if you look back at the first people to do this, the Dutch started doing it in the 1990s. And I think there were 6 or 7 people they had done it to in Amsterdam by about 2000. But in 2006, they did an actual research study with, if I remember correctly, 70 kids that they puberty blocked. And they believed that they had selected the kids who would not change their mind. That's what they called them, child transsexuals, meaning kids that they were sure would not change their mind. Because most kids do change their mind, by the way. We've known that for decades. There have been a dozen studies, all of which showed that the majority of kids who say when they're little that they, you know, that they think they're the opposite sex, the majority of them will stop doing that during their puberty, before even. Anyway, so they believed that they had selected the right kids, and then the question was how they could help them to pass. So it was explicitly a cosmetic intervention.
Sorry, I'm just going to interrupt there to say for people who, when you say to pass, that means to help people to pass means to in other words, fool the rest of us into looking at them and not realizing that they were really born up. Yeah, that's
And I mean, there's only any logic to doing that for boys anyway. Like, I absolutely don't approve of any of this, but you would only do it for boys because it's male puberty that stops people from passing. Mm-hmm. Like, women who take testosterone as adults pass pretty well as men because they start growing facial hair and, you know, they have to cut their breasts off. Okay, but you can do that. So there was only ever a logic for boys. But anyway, these people, they were just very sure. They were playing God, you know? And so they did this to 70 kids, and one of them actually died aged 18 because one of the things that puberty blockers and then taking estrogen as a boy does is your penis doesn't grow. So he still just had a little boy penis at 18. And that means that you've nothing to use to make the fake vagina that they make when they do the cross-sex surgery. Obviously, you can't make a real surgery out of a penis. Like, I'm sorry to have to say this to everybody. Like, my life took a dark turn when I started looking into this 6 years ago. I would love not to know what these surgeries involved, but I've had to look. So they take a bit of your colon and they use that to make up for the fact that there isn't much penis to use to make the fake vagina. And for this poor boy, that gave him necrotizing fasciitis and he died. So this study showed that 70 healthy kids went on, one died. It should have stopped there. You know, an intervention that is not life-saving and that actually kills somebody that's done on healthy children, physically healthy children, should never have gone any further. But somehow it did. It got picked up by American doctors. It got brought to America. And then it started to be done with a different rationale, which was that kids know who they are. Everybody knows who they are innately. Nobody can tell you whether you're a boy or a girl except yourself. And the distress as you said, of going into the wrong puberty, inverted commas, was so awful that you might kill yourself. And so it's now a life-saving intervention. And the reason for that is they worked out that what they were doing was really sterilizing healthy people. And I mean, that's a human rights abuse. The only reason you would ever sterilize a child is if they have a cancer that they're going to die with otherwise. Like, you might give radiotherapy or chemotherapy to a kid. You know, so it's got to be death on the other side of the weighing scales if you're going to do something like this. But that was post hoc rationalization. It started as, we can identify the right kids and it'll be a shame if they look like boys still. We want them to look like girls. And then off they went, and they started doing it then to teenage girls. And there were no teenage girls coming into clinics 20 years ago, and pretty much none even 15 years ago. And then 10 years ago, the child clinics basically saw nearly everybody they saw, like 70% and more all over the world, were teenage girls. And you have to ask yourself why, but those clinics didn't ask themselves why. Like, the amount of curiosity was nil. They just start, this treatment pathway that was about little boys, and the logic being, let's not have them look like, you know, transsexuals or cross-dressers when they're adults, let's have them look pretty, was then being used for teenage girls. They were being given puberty blockers and testosterone. And testosterone's like a one-way street. If you take testosterone, you can never undo the results. You know, your facial hair will continue to grow unless you get electrolysis. Your voice, you can never unbreak your voice. Like, a woman who takes testosterone at any point, even after just a few months, she'll have a deepened voice that never goes back. And if she's got the genes for male pattern baldness, her hair will start falling out and it will not grow back. So, yeah, it's been an even worse than usual medical scandal, I would say. And that's been obvious to anyone who gives it even a day or two's thought. Like, I was aware that it was a medical scandal of gross proportions. I was worried in 2017. And then when I met detransitioners first in 2019, I knew that something really terrible was happening. And it's been like feeling like you're Cassandra, that you're shouting and nobody's listening. And they're doing worse than mocking you, actually. They're telling you that you're a bigot and trying to get you to lose your job and turning up outside places that you want to speak to shout you down. But anyway, finally, the health minister, I think it was nearly 4 years ago, said something's going on here and commissioned Dr. Cass, who is a woman with a spine of steel, who just did her job. And, you know, she came under a great deal of pressure, but that report's great.
Well, this is a good place to pause and bring in Sarah, who's listened to all this. Sarah, you and I have talked about this issue, I suppose, in sort of broad, amateurish terms on this podcast before. But having heard it all laid out like that by Helen, what's your reaction?
I mean, like we've discussed it, it's a topic that I, you know, have felt really uncomfortable about for quite a while as well. And you know, I have three small children. You know, I have people close to me who've had some gender dysphoria as children, but I think what hearing Helen talk about it does is affirm for me a couple of things, and one of them is that I've begun to change my opinion, and I'd actually be curious about Helen's opinion on this, which, and I think my opinion used to be on this, you know, very like kind of quite liberal in the sense of like, you know, adults can do whatever they want and it's fine, and you know, none of my business, but you know. I'll call you whatever you want, but I don't have to believe this, that. And I think I'm becoming a bit more hardened because I actually think that going along with it has probably is part of the, it has caused some of the damage that, you know, we've been kind of like tricked into thinking that there's a correlation between kindness and quietness on this subject. And I think that, you know, like I said, I'd be curious what Helen thinks of this, but like, I think it's so damaging and such a scandal, and there will be children, and I've said this on this podcast before, there will be adults in the future, you know, sitting on in tribunals and suing the state for redress for was allowed to be done to them. And you know, is it better, does Helen, do you think it's better to stop going along with this in general, stop going along with the pronouns and the thing and like fight it hard in that way? Or do you think that there's a better way? Like, how do people listening to this podcast who agree with everything you're saying, tackle this in a day-to-day way, in a way that benefits children in the future?
Yeah, it's a big question. I mean, I think where you started is exactly where most people start. They think, you know, adults can do what they like. I'm a liberal. You know, if somebody wants to mutilate their body, they can mutilate their body. And they may not put it that starkly. They may think to themselves, you know, gosh, they're so distressed. If they, you know, it must be really distressing if you would think of cutting off your genitals to resolve that distress. You know, who am I to say that they can't do that? But children is a different matter. Like, that's a really, really common place that people land. But the thing is, you know, we do not anywhere in Europe have the sort of consumerized inverted commas medicine that they have in the States if you've got the money for it. You know, you sometimes see these things in the States of people who've had their ears cut off or they've had their tongues forked or they get their eyeballs tattooed and they call themselves a snake and they, you know, and that sort of thing. And, you know, if you've got the money for that in a consumerized system and you find yourself someone unethical enough to do it to you, you can as an adult. But we don't do that as healthcare. That's not healthcare. Because those things are driven by, I mean, the umbrella term is body dysmorphia, which is when people get really obsessed with some aspect of their body that, you know, they don't just think they're fat when they are fat. I just mean that it's like Michael Jackson's nose would be the best example I could give. Like Michael Jackson had the money and nobody's stopping him. And so he went from one surgeon to another and got more and more of his nose shaved off.
Yeah.
But nobody should do that as healthcare. It wasn't healthcare. It didn't help him. What he needed was psychiatric support. So I think now, you know, I really think that there is no evidence whatsoever that it really reliably helps adults to do these body modifications. Like individual people will tell you that it helped them, but that's always been true of every sort of medical intervention that later turns out to be useless. Like when they do things like oh, you know, the operations they did to knees or to tonsils or to ears or whatever, that later when they do the proper research, they discover it didn't actually help. You'll have found people who said it did help because it coincided with them feeling better anyway, or there was just the placebo effect, you know? So there genuinely isn't any good evidence that this is a sensible treatment pathway for anybody, adult or child. And then you think what doctors are meant to say. They're meant to say, first, do no harm. They have ethical standards. We don't train these people to be, you know, just body modification people. They're not tattoo artists written large. They're meant to be making people healthy. And there is no evidence that doing this makes people healthy. And then separately from that is your question about other people. Most people don't think to themselves, what does it mean to go along with the fiction about somebody else's sex? Like you just don't think, because most of the time we just move around and most of the time we aren't thinking much about whether we're male or female. I didn't. I certainly didn't when I was working at The Economist. I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to work today as a journalist, as a woman. You know, I went into the women's loos, sure, but it didn't really register with me that I was going into the women's loos and no men were, you know. But if you have to lie about other people's sex, it's surprising how often it comes back to bite you. You know, there's so many places where actually it does matter to know what sex people are. Yeah. And that's in single sex spaces, in sport, you know, in safeguarding. You need to know you can't look after kids unless you can identify who the adult men are, because adult men are the people who commit nearly all violent and really nearly all sexual crimes, especially against children. Mm-hmm. So you really, you know, you can't pretend a man is a woman and then keep children safe in their presence. You can't send people off on overnight trips if you're lying about the sex of any of the children or any of the teachers. And you know, you don't think these things through at first. You just think, oh, I'll be polite, I'll be nice. But I think, and I said this in the introduction to my book, you know, I'm often called unkind. And I mean, I don't like being unkind. I don't want to be unkind. But you know what? I'm the eldest of 9 kids. I'm used to a bit of emotional blackmail. I'm not going to do what I think is wrong just because somebody's going to throw a tantrum at me. So I never went along with be kind. No, I just want to say you be kind. The consequences of lying about sex are very, very, very unkind to a lot of people. Often the person themselves, but definitely to other people. So I won't do it. I won't do it anymore at all myself. I don't blame people who have to do it in work to keep their jobs. I don't blame people who have to do it in family situations or social situations because they know they'll be ostracized. I'm actually a genuine free speech advocate. If somebody wants to call people by their preferred pronouns, they can. I'm not going to tell them not to. I won't do it. I don't think it's kind, and I think it's a problem. And I think the final thing I'll say, sorry, I'm prone to sort of long three-part answers and people tell me off for it. But if you look at why they did all of this to children, like why they went after the children, it's because the children are required to prop up the adult identity claims. If you've got a middle, you know, middle-aged man who says that he's always been a woman, the fact is that man most likely is somebody who gets an erotic thrill out of cross-dressing, masturbating in his wife's knickers, whatever, and he wants to take that outside the bedroom now. He wants to cross-dress permanently. But nobody goes along with, oh, you know, I've been masturbating in knickers since I was in my teens, and now I want to go full-time. Like, that's not a human rights thing. But if you say, oh, I've always known I was a woman inside, like right from my earliest days, I knew that I was meant to be a girl and I really am a girl. People are very sympathetic. So you need there to be children who really are the opposite sex. So the children are the sacrifice. The children are necessary to prop up this whole story that adults are telling about themselves. And that's the thing that shocks me more than anything about all of this, that the children are the sacrifices.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, your point about being kind of, John and I have discussed this on the podcast before. You know, we had conversations about Dylan Mulvaney in America. And yeah, we talk about like there is a difference between like, I'm not going to be cruel to anyone, but I'm not going to be kind. And there's a difference. And, you know, I have three children and I care a lot more about this now than I did before I had children, because I don't want my kids, first of all, I don't want my kids' head being filled with garbage. That's not true. And also I want there to be safe spaces for my daughter or me to change and know exactly to your point and know who's there. I'm just consistently marvel at how women, a lot of women have just given up the ghost on a lot of their things that were sacred to women, spaces.
Yeah.
And just, you know, that they've been, that this Trojan horse has been gotten in into the female spaces, and they've allowed it and they accept it, and they shout you down and they want you to be cancelled and they call you names, and, you know, that they call you a bigot and you're a terrible, terrible person if you ask questions about it. But like, how did we get to a situation? I mean, I feel like a couple of years ago we were all talking about how important it was to promote women's sports. And now
I know.
Just like, you know, somehow, and you know, we had a Me Too movement that talked about, you know, women's sense of discomfort and women's sense of feeling harassed or invaded in any way was given the first proper hearing it's ever been given in society. And now, well, now if I say I feel uncomfortable with a man being in the changing room, I'm not allowed to say that. How what a short outing that concept got.
Isn't it amazing? Before you go on, John.
Yeah, because I want to kind of move the conversation on just a little bit, because it strikes me, listening to you both talk about this stuff, that, Helen, you're talking about what happened in the Tavistock Clinic. And by the way, Irish people should know, dozens of Irish children were sent by the...
Hundreds. It was 200 and something, I think.
200 and something Irish children were sent to the Tavistock Clinic in the UK by the HSE to receive the treatment that Helen is describing. But I think outside of those 200 children, what I think this comforts me most, because, I mean, in the broad scheme of things, I don't mean to sound callous in any way, and each one of those cases is a tragedy if they turn out wrong, but it's 200 kids out of a population of millions. But what's not 200 kids out of a population of millions is what's happening in schools. I mean, where just in this country alone, for example, I mean, there is barely a primary school in the country that doesn't have somewhere on the wall the transgender progress flag. The Irish National Teachers Organization, which is basically the primary school teachers union, produced a video 3 to 4 years ago for teachers, encouraging them or explaining to them how to socially transition children in their classes. You have, you know, multiple educational books now in schools, definitely in Ireland, and I suspect in the UK and in other jurisdictions as well, which teach this stuff not as theory, but as scientific fact. And the CAFS review, while welcome, only sort of deals with the medical pathway and isn't dealing with the cultural, the extent to which this has seeped into the bones of the culture, particularly among kids. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on that are. And I mean, we've got a guy who's in prison in Ireland, a teacher called Enoch Burke. Now, he's not in prison.
I know, yeah.
He's not in prison, it should be said, directly because he objected to socially transitioning a kid in school. The case moved on and he refused to obey various court orders and so on. But the row broke out, it's fair to say. The proximate cause of the situation is that he refused very publicly to participate in the social transitioning of a child in a post-primary school. And there has been very little institutional support for his position in Ireland, which is that is something I, as a teacher, have a right to conscientiously object to. So, I mean, how do you think we tackle the sort of the broader cultural sickness that legitimizes the stuff that's happening to 200 Irish kids and I don't know how many thousand kids in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, the kids who make it as far as any specialist gender service are absolutely just the tip of the iceberg. So when I started working with Sex Matters, the campaign group that I work with now, which was 2 years and a bit ago, pretty much exactly 2 years ago, they had just done a survey here in the UK and they asked secondary school teachers if they knew of any child who was trans-identifying in their school. And 70% of the teachers who replied said, like, and this is a balanced survey across the UK or possibly across England and Wales, they said there was at least one child who was identifying as trans in their school. So if you multiply that up, you get a far, far larger number than the ones who are ever seen by any specialist clinic. And I bet you loads of them aren't even going to see their doctor. I mean, I get constantly emails because I'm out there on this subject. I get constantly emails from parents saying, you know, I don't believe it. You know, they find out after a year or 2 years that the school has been referring to their girl as a boy and that the whole school, including the kids and other teachers, have been told not to say this in front of the parents. And somebody has just screwed up and let it out, you know. So this has become really common that schools take it upon themselves to do this. So, I mean, there's an awful lot to unpick. But the thing is that all these things, it's like, what's that game, pick up sticks? You know, when the sticks are all sort of wound up at each other and you've got to pick them up and you can't get them out without disturbing the other ones. You know, Hilary Cass pulled out one of them. And the question is, do other ones come down now? So the fact that she said, and one of the things she did say was that there is no good evidence that socially transitioning kids helps them and that you should be extremely cautious about doing it. And it certainly shouldn't be something that you would do lightly in primary school, especially. So socially transitioning for your listeners is when you present a child without taking any medical steps as a member of the opposite sex. It's only really plausible with little kids, but it doesn't stop them from doing it with secondary school kids. You know, anyone here in the UK in any school will know that there are kids who are clearly boys that everyone has to call a girl and vice versa. And you'll get punished under the anti-bullying rules if you forget or if you refuse. So that's going on. But I think that if you pull out the idea that you could go to a clinic, you take a lot of legitimacy away from that. And simultaneously, the government here has produced draft schools guidance, which really winds back on this. I mean, it says that under no circumstances can kids use the spaces that are for the opposite sex. It doesn't matter what they identify as, they can't do it. So a boy who identifies as a girl can never use the girl's spaces and vice versa. And so they are attacking it from both, but you've got to think of it as a schools and healthcare problem simultaneously. And then you've got to think, like, where are they getting these damn ideas from? Where are they, you know, where are kids getting this idea that we just didn't have in any numbers before about 15 years ago? Like, there were just a very few people who ever thought they were really meant to be the members of the opposite sex. Hardly anyone. The incident, the estimates of global incidence of what they call gender dysphoria, which is just a fancy word for gender distress, were 1 in 30,000 for males and 1 in 100 and something thousand, maybe 120,000 for females. And I mean, now it's, you know, at least 1 in 100 for each and probably more. So that's not a natural phenomenon. That's not just, you know, more reporting, especially when you think like it's switched from being little boys and middle-aged men to being overwhelmingly teenage girls.
Yeah.
There's some social phenomenon.
Let's talk about that, because I think almost that is the most interesting element of this whole discussion. I mean, the only thing I'd say about the UK and Ireland is that there is at least a conservative government in the UK, not conservative in all respects, they're not perfect, but they're alert to this. Whereas in Ireland, even with this review, we have a government and more pertinently, I think, a civil service and a permanent government that is still 100% in hock to the idea.
Can I just say the civil service is the same here and we're going to have a Labour government soon. Now, they've said some good things about Cass, but let us see. And also, we've had a Conservative government here for 14 years and all of this has happened under them.
Mm, yes, well, that is an entirely apt criticism. But let's talk about why this is exploding, because I think it's really interesting. You've done a lot of really interesting work on it, because an observation I always make, and I don't think it's an original observation that I make, Nick, but somebody noted it once and it always stuck with me, which is there are no middle-aged trans men. As in women of sort of 45 and above who wake up one day and say, I've actually been a man my whole life. There are lots of middle-aged men, you know, who say that they've always been a woman, but there are virtually no women of that age group who are saying the opposite. While amongst the young, as you've noted several times correctly, it's overwhelmingly young girls. So there's this kind of odd duopoly of it being primarily middle-aged men and teenage girls. And that to me screams of there's something really wrong happening here. What do you think it might be?
Well, the first thing that it indicates is that, you know, sex is real, folks. And men and women are not the same, and girls and boys are not the same. And I mean, I don't know how anyone could think that we were when you think that we're mammals and that we evolved and that, you know, the female of the species is the one that carries pretty much all the burden of reproduction. And in our species, that's particularly burdensome. Like, we have a particularly tough time of it, giving birth and long babyhoods and long childhoods. So it's not surprising that men and women have different mentalities as well as physicalities. And we know they do. Like, men and women have reliably fairly different interests. Of course, overlapping, you always have to say that there are atypical examples, but...
And women never
men and women are different.
Man flu, it has to be said. Just, you know, you can talk about childhood.
Yeah, well, there's an example, you know. Exactly. And then there are physical differences. I mean, women's immune systems are genuinely stronger. That's one of the reasons that we live for 7 years longer. So there's all these differences between us. It's not just about who's stronger, the men or who has the babies, the women. Men and women's sexualities are rather different too. You know, men are much more interested in youth, the signs of youth and fertility. So, you know, men pay a lot more attention to, there's a very funny chart that shows the age of the man and the age of the woman he thinks is most attractive. And once it gets to about 21 with the woman, it just basically stays there as the man gets older. And that's just not true for women. Women think men near their own age are the most attractive. Like, I can't imagine at age 55 having a 21-year-old boyfriend. What the hell would I talk to him about? You know, like, that's the age of my son. But men do that all the time. They have girlfriends, you know, if they're rich enough, they just keep dumping their wives and having a girlfriend who's the same age as the one they started with last time. So that's just one example. So men care more about variety. They care more about youth. They don't much care about the status symbols. They don't, like, you know, you don't get men's porn that describes in great detail the labels of the women's clothes and tells you how many languages she speaks and, you know, her graduate degrees and how much she earns and things like that. But if you read women's erotica, I mean, there's a very good book called A Billion Wicked Thoughts that does an analysis of women's erotica. And it's so much of it is proof that the man is competent, admired, high status, capable, trustworthy, like all these things that make sense when you think what it is to get pregnant and to have a baby and really need the man to stick around and need him to be high quality because of the investment you put in. So we wouldn't be surprised that something that's obviously so closely linked to sex as whether you want to identify as your sex or the opposite sex would be very different in men and women or boys and girls. And indeed it is. So the two big reasons that male people want to identify as female are, one, historically speaking, and this has been more the case, they're gay and they're very, very effeminate and they become very dysphoric because people are so horrible to effeminate men. I hope that as homophobia becomes rarer, that becomes rarer too. But, you know, when you look back at the records of gender clinics that we've been seeing people for 60, 70 years, that was a significant number of the men. These men knew they weren't women. They just had worked out that they couldn't live happily in society that hated them so much unless they presented themselves as women. And then the other group are nothing like that. They're men who are erotic cross-dressers and who have allowed erotic cross-dressing to completely become a fixation and to take over their lives. And they're not particularly feminine at all in their, you know, in their typical interests or their style or their looks or anything like that.
There's a growing trend that's been written about in several places in pornography targeted at men, which kind of eroticizes transgender men. Males who become women or
so for your listeners, what we're talking about is people with penises and boobs, ladyboys.
And that's been a trend, which I assume is kind of it like, because you're talking about a fetish there, and there does seem to be a, because pornography I think has driven trends in sexuality for 20 years now, and it seems to me that it's driving things in that direction as well, but there are...
So that has been an interest for a long time. There have always been Europeans for decades and decades who've gone to Thailand for the ladyboys. I wish I didn't know these things. You know, I used to be the finance editor of The Economist, but I mean, it's just a fact. So there's a specific interest. So men whose sexuality is structured around wishing that they were women and imagining and fantasizing about having a woman's body and about cross-dressing, they're given this fancy name that comes from the Greek, which is autogynephilia, love of oneself as a woman. And then there are men whose main target interest is men who have undergone partial feminization, men who've maybe had fake boobs or taken estrogen to grow boobs and who dress as a woman but have kept their male genitalia. So even before the internet, I mean, I've read studies of personal ads that say things like, you know, 7-inch surprise or something like that, with a picture of a very pornified looking, what looks like a woman. And now, of course, on the internet, there's a lot of that. So I think that's always been there. And maybe there's more of it. Maybe it's easier to get hold of. Maybe men who would never have discovered that that excites them now can if they go on Pornhub. But something that we do see is a process of grooming of teenage boys to think that life would be better if they were a woman. So these boys who fall for the sort of Andrew Tate end of things often think, you know, girls have got everything now. Like, feminism has ruined everything. Women are on top. Unless you're an alpha male, it's no good being a boy. Like, just suppose you're just an ordinary, not very fit, not very handsome. You know, you think the economy is rigged against you, and you're probably right. You're not going to get an amazing job. Houses are too expensive. Girls have it easier because men buy them things, and they can, you know, just they don't even have to work. You know, they have this incredibly unrealistic idea of what it is to be a woman. And if you're in certain places on Reddit, or if you watch certain TikTok videos, and it used to be Tumblr, there are people who are selling that, and whose fun is in encouraging unhappy, often in autistic spectrum disorder boys down a path over months, and maybe longer than months, to come to think that they must, their unhappiness means that they're transgender and that life will be easier if they identify as a girl. So that's just one of the things that the internet is doing. And we haven't even talked about the teenage girls, you know.
Well, before we do, Sarah, you're the mother of two young boys. Does that terrify you?
I mean, like, as if there isn't anything else to worry about. I mean, I think all of it is terrifying for parents. And I think that this bad actors and, you know, people like, you know, I mean, I think of it as a cult. So, you know, I remember years ago seeing some documentary that was really sad about, you know, these parents going to this place in, you know, somewhere in America in the middle of nowhere and kind of banging on the front doors of this compound and trying to see their kids who wouldn't see them. And now I think there's no need for that compound anymore, that your kids can get kind of brought into this cult and you can be banging from the outside and there's nothing you can do to get in. And I think that that's really terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, children have never before in the history of humanity been left to, in significant respects, bring each other up without adult oversight. So we've just gone through a 20-year period where what children are looking at, and by children, I mean little children, but also teenagers, and then increasingly people in their early 20s, is just different from what people above that age group are looking at. And what seems obvious to them, and like everybody knows things, you know, those of us who are certainly over 35 and maybe even 30, we're just blissfully unaware of it, you know, what's being said in these groups. And so there's this breakage of links between the generations and of oversight of children. And then bad actors can come in. But even without the bad actors, you know, kids are naive. They're ignorant of the way the world works. They don't have that spidey sense that grown-ups, especially grown-up mothers, get over time about, you know, why is he so interested in talking to my kids? Like, children are just naive. So they're there, you know, they're there. They're sitting ducks for people who want to come in, either to pretend that they're other kids. You know, people think, oh, it must all be about paedophilia and it must be about child porn. But there's also this very insidious thing of befriending vulnerable kids and just for the fun of it, confusing them and encouraging them to do something that, I don't know, it's just for shits and giggles sometimes, but sometimes it's also about validating that man's identity as a woman himself. And it can all be done in their bedroom, and you know nothing about it as a parent unless you choose to educate yourself. And then at the same time, like John said, schools are lying to the kids. So they're getting it from everywhere. They're getting it from the law, they're getting it from schools, they're getting it from medical discourse, and they're getting it online. So, you know, Hilary Cass dealt a fairly significant blow to one part of it, the medicalization. All parts reinforce each other. If you talk to someone about one of them, like if you say to teachers what you're teaching them is wrong, they'll say, oh, but the government says I should, but look at what doctors are saying, and haven't you seen this source online? And every one of them will blame all the others. So we've got to just keep pushing at all of them and knock them down individually when we can.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, but I have to ask, if there's someone listening who has a child who comes to them and says, I think I want to be a boy, or I think I want to be a girl, or whatever, what do you think they should do?
God, it's really tough, because the thing is, they won't come and say that to you until they've been researching for quite a long time online, and they'll have all their scripts and rebuttals. There are all these scripts about how you come out to your parents and what they'll say to you. And the thing is, if your parents, you know, as a parent, you're likely to say that's nonsense. They say, what do you mean? Like, but you've never, you know, you've never seemed to be unhappy about being a girl, or, you know, we never said this before, any of those things. But they know what to say back to you. So they're quite hermetically sealed, because they have already been significantly indoctrinated before you know a damn thing about it. So ideally, you don't get that far. Like, if you, it's one of those I wouldn't start from here things. Ideally, you talk about what it means to be male or female, how those are things that can't change, but they really shouldn't hold you back. You know, if you're a girl and you want to be president, we've had how many female presidents at this point in Ireland? You can be president. You know, you can do anything. You can go into space. If you're a boy and you don't like rugby, boys do not have to like rugby. They can do whatever they like to. And, you know, you get that message in first, ideally, so that your child is significantly inoculated from the rubbish. But suppose you're not that person. Suppose it comes out of nowhere. I would just be really kind of open-minded and questioning, and never rubbish anything, especially with a teenager. They're hypersensitive to it, to being told that they're talking nonsense or that they don't know what they're talking about. So you just say, oh, you know, that's really interesting. What does that mean to you? Yeah, I'm not up on this. And you can't tell them anything. Like, if you tell them, look, this is nonsense and here's the logical proof why it's nonsense, you just get their back up. You've got to get them to, you've got to make cracks in their narrative. So, I mean, I'm thinking of a particular family who talked to me over some months after their daughter started identifying as non-binary and then a boy in school. And this had been going on for quite a while before they found out, I think like 18 months. But they had a very strong relationship with her. I mean, that's another thing. Keep the relationship strong. And so she was willing to listen to their concerns, and they you know, they got on to me and they said, should we buy her a breast binder? That's what she wants. And they're very dangerous. Like, those are, that's, it's like breast ironing. Like, this is something that will deform your spine and your lungs and cause you significant pain and push you onto a medicalized pathway because it's so miserable. So I said to them, absolutely not. Like, you know, show her this research. And I sent them the research that shows how dangerous this is. And she looked at it and she was deeply upset that she was about to do something so damaging to herself. And she said, but why are all the lobby groups, like, why does Stonewall say that this is totally fine and healthy? And why does Mermaid say that it's fine? And her mum said, well, you know, who do you think has your best interests at heart? Me or some lobbyists who are paid and who've never met you? And her daughter said, well, I think you do. And so they agreed that they would go and get her a sharp boy's haircut, the best fitting sports bra they could find. You know, some boys' baggy clothes. They didn't mind a nickname. They weren't going to call her, you know, a boy or any of that. And honestly, she just kind of found her own way back. But the start of it was realizing that her parents were on her side and the lobbyists weren't. So that's the aim, whatever way that is in your conversations. You're on their side.
I want to talk about something that, you know, because I'm a huge fan of the, I'm sure you know who I'm speaking of, Helen, Louise Perry.
She's great.
I don't know how to label Louise. She kind of defies labels, but she basically wrote a book recently strongly criticizing feminism and the sexual revolution.
Yeah, against the sexual revolution, yeah, it's called.
And it made me think a lot about the differences between being a man and being a woman today and being a man and being a woman, say, when Sarah and I were going through puberty in the mid-90s. And it strikes me that being a young man in many ways hasn't changed in terms of the expectations placed upon you, the ways in which success is measured on the sporting field, economic success, how good you are with girls, so on and so forth. Whereas the expectations on young women in particular have dramatically shifted, both in terms of, like, you know, you need to have a career. You also need to be, you need to compare yourself against influencers on TikTok who are always perfectly manicured, living amazing lives in the Bahamas. Your expectations when you do meet a boy are now no longer, let's be diplomatic, because it's a family podcast. It's no longer a kiss behind the bike shed, let's put it that way. You know, expect to be an acrobat.
Mm.
And her theory, I think, is that a lot of young women are simply looking for a way out of the modern expectations put on young girls in particular. Do you think that's true? Do you think it's a primary factor? Do you think it's a secondary factor? What do you think is driving this amongst young girls in particular?
Yeah, so the thing about femininity is that it tends to be contradictory everywhere. Like, you're simultaneously meant to be very attractive and available, but also pure and, you know, to make, it's your fault if anything happens. Like, you're meant to put out, but if anything bad happens, it'll be your fault. And that's a very, very common everywhere sort of double bind on women and young girls. And then another thing that happens for young girls is typically you develop physically some years before you're ready for attention from men. And as I said, men like young women. So, you know, a lot of, I mean, you know, the fact is that a 14-year-old who's been through puberty, she may look very beautiful. And of course, if you're not a total pervert of a man, you'll avert your eyes and, you know, not try and make her uncomfortable and things. But sadly, some men are absolute perverts. And, you know, you'll get wolf whistled at 13 or 14 when you're not ready for it at all. So it's always been a very difficult period going through puberty, much more so for girls than boys. And I forgot about periods as well. Like, it's just really a bit shit, you know? And so it's already a problem. And then if you put on top of that, if you look at the way that girls are meant to turn themselves out now and the way that they're meant to present themselves on Instagram and TikTok, like, it's beyond anything the way they're meant to groom themselves. Like, you know, the false eyelashes. If you stand outside a secondary school, certainly here in Southeast England, you will see girls of only 13, 14 who've had lip plumping. They're wearing enormous false eyelashes. They're wearing a lot of makeup. They've got, you know, they just really look pornified before I think they have any idea what they are even like trying to look like, you know. Suppose you're just not that girl. Suppose you just couldn't do it. You don't want to, or you couldn't. You think you're too plain, or you're too fat, or it's just not you. There's no other version of girl. And there used to be, you know, you were the quirky sort of emo, or just that you were the kind of sciencey sort of girl. And now that girl calls herself non-binary because there's no other way of saying that she's not that, especially the way that schools present it. So I'm really starting to think that people have no ability to carry through a logical argument, because what it means to be progressive in the good sense about teenage boys and girls is to say to them, look, sex is real, can't change sex, don't let it hold you back, you do you. And then, you know, take that as the foundation for your anti-bullying policy. You know, you will not accept boys being told that they're poofters, and you will not accept girls being forced to do cooking or anything like that. And then what they do is they do the opposite. They tell the children that if you like cooking, you must be a girl. And if you like rugby, you must be a boy. And I've said this to teachers and they say, oh, that's not what I'm saying. But I look at the teaching materials and it is bloody well what they're saying. So I don't know why they think they aren't saying that. They bloody are. So some girl who looks and says, you know, I don't want to be that. I don't want false eyelashes. I don't want all that makeup. I don't want to be sounding like a valley girl. Like, what's left for her is to be non-binary. And if she just kind of settles on non-binary and wears baggy clothes and gets a funky haircut and annoys everybody by saying her pronouns are they, them, then, you know, what harm in a way? But it's still regressive. It's saying that she can't be that and be a girl. Yeah, so it's binding it all tighter.
The funny thing is, Sarah and I discussed actually this very topic on this show before. I mean, Sarah will remember we've got this annual TV event in Ireland that's kind of overblown, but it's a massive annual TV event called the Late Late Toy Show, where kids come on and they sample all Santa's toys before Christmas and everyone sits around the TV and watches.
Oh, yeah, I've seen bits of it, yeah.
And about 10 years ago, like, feminists in Ireland were running this massive campaign about gender stereotyping on the Late Late Toy Show. So basically the problem was all the little boys would come on and they'd be given Action Man, and all the little girls would come on and they'd be given Barbie, and they said, this is terrible, this is reinforcing gender stereotype. You know, boys can play with Barbie and girls can play with Action Man, which is of course 100% true and correct, and now that's all gone. Now it is like, you know, boys like Action Man, girls like Barbie, and you know, boys are now basically determining your gender as opposed to the other way around. Sarah, am I exaggerating?
Yeah. I don't think you're exaggerating.
No, but it's also, it's worse because it's, you know, we discussed Dylan Mulvaney in America. I mentioned him and he released a song, Days of Girlhood. And it's that, like, now femaleness, womanness, girlness is a kind of bit. Like, based on all of the stereotypes that women would have been fighting against, and it would have been considered progressive before, to shed some of this stuff. And his song and his bit is that girlhood is kind of like, you know, one night stands and pillow fights at sleepovers and, you know, crying all the time and shopping and maxing out your credit card. And it's like this whole bimbo bit is now back as the image of girlhood, which would have been, you know, we would have been fighting against a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I look at these things, especially I look at when women retweet them or comment on them, and I just want to say to them, do you have no self-respect?
Yeah.
Like, I understand why Dylan Mulvaney is doing it. I don't admire him for it, but I understand why he's doing it. You know, it's made him famous. Presumably he gets off on it in some way. I don't know what sort of way, whether that's just that. I honestly wonder, did he start this as a sort of a joke and then it took off? But anyway, he's getting something out of it. He's getting fame, money. He does ad endorsements and so on. What the girls who are sucking it, and the women who are sucking up to it, get out of it is a mystery to me. I think they have to get some sort of performative goodness out of it. Like, look at me, I'm so kind.
Yeah.
And, you know, women fall for that bullshit. Like, men do not fall for that bullshit the same way. And I really resent it because it's kindness on behalf. It's fake kindness, as we've already discussed, but it's also on behalf of other people. Like, if they were just humiliating and denigrating themselves, I wouldn't care. But they're humiliating and denigrating all women by going along with this. So just, you know, back off. Like, it's disgusting what he's doing.
But also, that would be appropriate, you know, wearing woman face. It wouldn't be appropriate to do that with any other, you know, with any other group of people. But we're supposed to sit back and just take it that we're being reduced to kind of a joke.
I know. And I don't get it. I don't think it's funny. I think he's disgusting. Not as a human being. I'm not saying the human being is disgusting, because these things always get quoted out of context. I think what he's doing is disgusting. And I don't know why anyone goes along with it. So why do women go along with it? It's a good question, because, you know, when you do polls, and we've done polls at Sex Matters, it's women aged under 25, sort of 18 to 25, who are the people who are most keen on this stuff. They're the most likely to say that men who identify as women should be allowed into women's sports, the most likely to say that they'll use preferred pronouns, the most likely to say that a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman. I mean, I think that they've been targeted the most by it. If you think about who I said wants to transition, the powerful group who want to transition are the middle-aged men. Because they're the men who've already maybe, you know, got places in their career, they've got money, they're often quite hard-charging people who haven't heard the word no very often in their lives. And what they want is recognition from women. It's not recognition from men. Men are basically irrelevant to them. They want women to accept them in women's spaces, in women's sports, etc., because these are the last frontier for them to conquer, basically. So it's been women and girls much, much, much more than men and boys who have been, you know, relentlessly bullied and targeted for 20 years now. And one institution after another has fallen. So the National Organization for Women in the States is basically a transactivist organization now. Same with the Women's Law Center in the States. The Women's Equality Party here in the UK got destroyed by this issue. It got taken over by It's For Anybody, Women's Institute. Like, every women's group has fallen. And then those groups become very powerful in pushing this idea, but also in basically making it impossible in large numbers of careers to get ahead unless you go along with this, if you're a woman. Like, I've talked to male journalists about this, and they don't get the shit that I got. It's the women who talk about this who get the shit. So I think that a lot of it is that it's women who are targeted. But I also think there's a lot of performative, I'm kinder than you. Boys don't tend to compete by being very virtuous at each other. And, you know, like, they're more likely to give someone a punch than to kind of, you know, ostentatiously ostracize somebody for not being kind enough. And then the last thing I'd say is that I think there's a lot of women who actually think rather poorly of women. They're, you know, the fancy word being internal misogyny. And the idea that a man thinks that womanhood is so attractive that he might want to be in it, that's like validating. Like, a man wants to be a woman. How amazing. He's going to be the best woman. You know, I see these tweets sometimes and things on Instagram and on Flickr where men share their photographs of themselves as women. And I mean, they look a state. Like, they haven't tidied the room behind them. They just really look awful. And then there's dozens of women underneath saying, oh, you go, girl, look at your lipstick, I wish I could do my eyeshadow like yours. And you're like, again, have you no self-respect? Yeah. So I wonder what they're getting out of it, but they're getting something out of it.
A lot of those photos, I've seen the very strong Buffalo Bill vibes from Silence of the Lambs.
You said it, not I.
there's another element to this, though, which is which I want to talk about, because we don't have a whole lot of time left. And I do want to talk about this, which is the sort of perception that this whole argument is kind of low status. I was talking to a middle-aged, very otherwise very sensible middle-aged man a couple of weeks ago, and the topic of J.K. Rowling came up. And what he said was, oh yeah, she's broadly right, but I just don't know why she wasted all her career and her credibility talking about this issue. As if, and the way he said this issue, and I'm not misrepresenting him, because I know exactly what he meant. It was kind of like, this isn't the kind of thing that kind of polite, well-meaning, respectable people talk about. Like, there's that sense out there, and definitely amongst, in my experience, sort of people who consider themselves political centrists, liberal, open-minded, vote for gay marriage, pro-choice, women's right to choose, live life as you want to live. That kind of attitude is very much the culturally dominant attitude in the West. You've got a lot of middle-class people who kind of, they look at you, Helen, as somebody, somebody who went from the heights of working for, as I mentioned at the beginning, The Economist, which is the magazine for really smart people, to now working for what they would see as an obscure institute concerned with something that, you know, who cares about it really? That is a really toxic and pernicious attitude in society. And I think it's an excuse for people to not think about the issue, just to write it off as not important. I mean, do you think I'm onto something there? Because I've definitely encountered that.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason is they're quite right that it's extremely stupid. Like, you know, it's just extraordinarily stupid to think that you could define man and woman as self-identified categories. If someone were to go back 50 years and say, or even 30 years and say that we would be here where we are now, like, you would just write it off as too implausible. So if you're not in spaces where this comes up, as I wasn't in The Economist, like, this was literally something that a commissioning editor asked me to write about because she had kids much younger than mine. And she said, why do the kids keep coming home and saying such and such is trans now? And I had never heard of it. I'd never heard of Judith Butler. I'd never heard of gender identity. I was only vaguely aware that there was this thing that somebody called, that people called sex change. I didn't know what it was involved. Well, you know, I'd never met any, you know. So it was completely, I was finance editor at the Economist when I was writing my book. And, you know, I have a lot of sympathy with people who say that this is just so dumb and that this has to be just so few people that it cannot be beyond the wit of man to just sort it out for those individuals, because that's true. What they don't realise, and what it takes a while before you realise, is that it's a totalising theory. It's not a theory about trans people, it's a theory about all people. You know, you and I and Sarah are men or women not because of our bodies or just because we were what we were conceived as. It's what we identify as. And if any of us were to identify as something different, we would be that different thing. So it changes how everybody is to think about themselves, but it takes you a while to notice that. And I would say as well, those other things like gay marriage and women's rights, they were low status when they came in first. Like, if you look back at the dismissive coverage of the suffragettes, and, you know, I have friends who were, you know, founding members of Stonewall and founding members of the Gay Liberation Front back in the 1970s, 80s. And they were talked about in the same, you know, why would you care about that? This is nothing. You know, high status topics are finance, economics, international relations, nuclear weapons, politics, you know, those sorts of things. Things that affect mostly gay people, women and children are always low status. And this topic does affect women and children and gay people more than adult men. It just does.
The other thing I find, and I'm sure, Sarah, you find this as well, is that people actually just don't believe you.
Like, so, yeah, example, totally.
In Ireland, for example, we have what you don't have in the UK and what they tried to introduce in Scotland, but we have had for many years now full gender recognition. So the law in Ireland is that legally, this is the law, I can tomorrow become just as much a woman in the eyes of the law as either you or Sarah, Helen, by filling out a form. And after that, I'm in the eyes of the law in the Irish state, no matter the fact that I've never had a child, I've never had a period, I'm not going to say I don't have breasts, because some people would argue.
You're just not a woman. It's that simple. You're just a man.
Not a break it down.
But the, you know, that is the, and you tell people this and they're like, nah.
You're, I know. You're making that up. Think you've got a tinfoil hat.
Yep. Yeah.
That is a huge problem for the journalism.
And so, so I, sorry,
the creative far right, I've had that said to me, that this is just something that's kind of been made up by far right crazy people, and it's not really a real problem that ever actually exists day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a famous progression of things online. They start by saying it's not happening and that you're, you know, you're a conspiracy theorist or you're in the pay of the American far right or something if you say it's happening. So then you give them chapter and verse and then they grudgingly admit that it sometimes is happening. And then they get to the point that not only is it happening, but it's good that it's happening. And I've seen that happen with so many of these issues. No, we're not sterilizing kids, they'll say. Nobody is doing anything irreversible on children anywhere in the world. That's a conspiracy theory. And then you point them to some American article about a 15-year-old boy who was castrated on Medicaid, as I have done. There was a 15-year-old boy who was castrated on Medicaid and given a fake vagina. And then they're like, yeah, well, he must have really needed it. She must have really needed it. Like, that's different. It's good that it happened. It's like, you know, the expression policy-based evidence making. Like, you start with the end that you want and then you work out what the evidence is that gives that. Like, you know, as far as these people are concerned, you know, the Republicans are bad and the Democrats are good. The right is bad, the left is good. And, you know, I'm not left-wing, right-wing. I'm not pro-bloody Donald Trump. I think the guy's a clown. It's just that sometimes he's right. Sometimes the Republicans are right. They're wrong about a lot of things, but they're right on child gender medicine. But they can't be right because of polarization. It's just not acceptable. They can't be right on anything. And if you look at the backgrounds of the people in the so-called meaning-making institutions, academia, journalism, publishing, HR, big multinational organizations, charities, all of those are just overwhelmingly staffed by people who are on the left. And as far as they're concerned, these things, if they, you know, if they're believed by Donald Trump, if they're believed by the conservatives, they must be wrong. And they will do anything to continue with that belief.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a lifelong conservative, let me tell you that resonates with me, because people just write ideas off based on nothing other than the fact that they're being uttered by, not necessarily me, but by a conservative force. They will just write it off. Like, the number of times you see somebody tweeting something online, like, a story might come out in, I don't know, the Daily Telegraph. And the response will just be Daily Telegraph, LOL.
Yeah, or Daily Mail. That's the one they do it with most. They just reply saying Daily Mail.
Yeah. So it can't be true, even though those publications are held to the same standards by the press regulator as the Guardian or the Independent. So, I mean...
You can just go and look. You can find the police report. You know, you can see that it's true yourself.
People don't want to. Anyway,
yeah, I mean, can I just say one thing about this, though, which is I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that the people who have fought hardest against this here in the UK are on the left. They're women on the left, often very, very left wing, often lifelong, like Labour members who were in trades unions and so on. They would have a strong feminist analysis that's rooted in material reality. And that's what proofed them against this bullshit. So I'm thinking about people like Julie Bindell and the Women of Woman's Place UK, amazing women who have, you know, no right-wing influence, but who stood fast against this bullshit. And to such an extent that, because I'm not left-wing, and I wouldn't say I was particularly right-wing either, I would have said I was centrist until that became such a dirty word by the, you know, now I think the technocratic centre are the people who got us into all the shit. But anyway, you know, they assumed that I was left-wing too. And then somebody said something about something that I said and said, gosh, that's, you know, that's like very right-wing. And I said, well, I'm the finance editor of The Economist. You can't possibly think that I'm very left-wing. And this caused a whole kerfuffle among my entire set over weeks, played out on Twitter, like people going, oh my God, she says she's not left-wing. You know, it's amazing to see. Oh.
Well, look, we've had the exact same experience here in Ireland. I mean, I've had women come up to me on this who would have, like, because I've been a fairly prominent, but not majorly prominent sort of conservative voice in Ireland, an Ireland that is not at all conservative for, you know, coming on 15 years now. And I've had, I don't know how many women come to me who say, I hated you 5 years ago. And I understand why. I'm not criticizing them for that. I understand why. And to be honest with you, some of the animosity would probably have been mutual. But it's absolutely true to say that there are an awful lot of left-wing feminists who recognize the threat here and probably have recognized it on an intellectually deeper level than some people on the right would have been.
Absolutely. I think people on the right are sometimes thinking that, you know, it's about social roles. They're like, men should be manly and women should be womanly, but that's part of what got us here. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not the main thing that got us here, but it is part of it.
Okay. Well, look, I think we've chatted for just over an hour. So, Sarah, do you want to take us home?
I just have one more question, Helen. So you kind of touched on it before. You said that Dr. Cass has kind of given a big body blow to this entire ideology or this movement. Oh, I suppose my question is, because I feel in my bones that something is definitely, the grip is loosening a little bit here. What do you think?
Yeah.
Do you think is going to happen next?
So one thing that we haven't talked about is, I touched on it, but it's the fact that when you enforce a lie about your own sex on other people, you impact upon their rights. Mm. It's a bit like being from a religion that doesn't accept that other people don't believe. So like being a crusader, you know? So this movement has been not just a religion, but a totalizing religion, like one that sees itself as a state religion. You're not allowed to be an atheist. And I think people are realizing that increasingly. And they're willing to let you do you. If you want to think that you're a girl or a boy, you can do it. I mean, I don't think that anymore about children and about vulnerable adults. But anyway, it's a starting point. But then not if it influences them or affects them. And more it is affecting other people. Like, if there's even one boy in a girls' sports league, it affects all the girls, really large numbers of them, and so on and so forth. So more and more people are waking up to this one. And if you wake up to this and you think, God, this is such bullshit. Like they said that, you know, I thought this was a tiny minority of people who had really severe issues and they'd be really well behaved. And the men who said they were women would be very like women. And here's this, you know, hairy arse bloke who's a double rapist and he's just been sentenced in Scotland and he suddenly discovers that he's a woman after sentencing, which is what happened last year. And then they go, this is bullshit. And then they think, like, what else is bullshit? Like, the whole thing can come down. It's very trust-destroying, this ideology. That's the bad thing about it. But the good thing is I think it shakes everything up and it stops people being in these silos where they think the other side is wrong about everything and they're right about everything. And you start making friends across the aisle. So I think it feeds out into other arguments about identity politics more generally, like about race, about putting these thin identities, like self-defined identities, ahead of everything that's to do with connections with your community or your family. And that strikes me as a jolly good thing. Like, I've met so many great people through this and I've made so many very different friends through it that's been incredibly stimulating intellectually for me. And I think a lot of people say the same. They lost a lot, but they gained a lot too.
Well, that's a positive note on which to end the conversation. Helen, it's been an absolute honour to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on.
And I know you're. Are you speaking in Dublin at the Countess event in a couple of weeks?
I can't. We have our strategy weekend once a year, and it was booked like 6 months ago. So when Leisha got on to me and told me her date, I had to say, I'm really sorry. I'm in the wilds of Sussex with my colleagues Friday evening.
I'm sorry, you won't be there, but I do know that on Saturday the 27th, which is 1 week from tomorrow, if you're listening on Friday. The Countess are having an event. The Countess is obviously, for those of you who don't know, sort of the main Irish lobby group working on this issue. They're having a conference in the RDS to discuss all of the issues that we've discussed on this podcast and indeed many more. So that's on Saturday the 27th. Only fair to give them a shout out for that event, which I will be speaking at, as indeed with many other people. So that's, I think, a good place to end. So thanks once again to Helen. Thank you to Sarah for putting up with me dominating the conversation.
Have there been any good goals or kicks or whatever it is in what you're watching?
Yes, Liverpool are leading by a goal to nil. They need to win by four, though. So I'm optimistic for Atalanta, especially. The problem is the referee has been disgracefully biased. But before I lose any more,
I didn't really care, John.
Yeah, we're both conforming to our gender stereotypes that we don't.
All right. Well, I will go watch the match. The rest of you can go do whatever you want to do until next week.
Go do my nails, John, and do my hair extensions.
how gender stereotypical. Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Bye.